It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, our guest says when we think of the 1960s, the myth sometimes outweighs the reality, but it's vital that we understand how the 60s shaped our modern era.
First, Governor Walker has officially submitted his opposition to a set of federal environmental proposals. The Obama administration is asking the state to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by the year 2030.
The governor says Wisconsin can't afford the hefty price tag that would come with implementing the new environmental standards. He says making the move from coal power to natural gas to meet those guidelines would lead to reliability issues for consumers.
Michael Kraft is with us now. He's a professor emeritus of public and environmental affairs at the UW-Green Bay. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Governor Walker says the price tag to implement the Obama administration's new clean air rules is around $13.4 billion. What do you make of that number?
I'm not sure what to make of it. It's a very large number, and I can understand that it would frighten some people to think the state of Wisconsin will spend $13 billion. What is not clear in the press releases that I've seen is what time period we're talking about. The EPA estimates for the entire country that by the year 2030, when these rules would be fully in force, it will cost between $7.3 and $8.8 billion per year. However, what the governor does not mention, nor the Department of Natural Resources or Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, is EPA says the benefits are roughly 10 times that, $55 billion to $93 billion per year over the life of the rule. You know, so it's easy to criticize any proposal. Well, it's going to cost money. But, you know, it's an equation. You have to look at the benefits of any rule, and the benefits come and improve public health and reduction in the economic costs of climate change. So it sounds frightening that we'd have to spend this much. But I would say, first of all, it's by no means clear that the governor and the DNR are even considering the benefits. And if they have and say, well, it still seems excessive or that Wisconsin is being treated more harshly than other states.
Right. That's another one of the governor's points, that Wisconsin has an excessive burden when it comes to these new rules, that Wisconsin would have to look at 34% reduction instead of 30%, for instance. Yeah. What about that? Is Wisconsin being treated unfairly?
That's probably true, and the reason is that Wisconsin is heavily dependent on the use of coal for generating electricity. The last time I checked, and the numbers I jotted down in front of me, is Wisconsin depends for the production of electricity 65% on coal and only 8.7% on natural gas. Many states, such as California, would be the reverse. That is almost wholly on natural gas and renewables and almost nothing on coal. So Wisconsin and other states in the Midwest and parts of the East Coast are more heavily dependent on coal, and that's a pattern that the EPA would like to change. And the reason is that coal is a very dirty fuel. It dramatically affects public health, and it is the chief contributor to climate change. About 40% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. come from the burning of coal in electrical generating plants. And Wisconsin just lost a nuclear power plant recently. So it's not a surprise that the state would be a little more heavily affected. But I would also suggest that people need to look at the EPA rule. And yesterday was the last day to comment on the proposed rule. The final rule, of course, may be very different. And that is what the governor and the DNR and the business community are looking for. That is a set of rules that will be a little kinder toward Wisconsin.
Right.
And
the governor has.
And it may be the case.
The governor has asked to have some lenience in meeting some of these benchmarks by 2020, also asking that Wisconsin get some credit for past investments made in clean energy already. Is that something you think that would impact this?
And I'm sure the EPA will consider it. But I think what doesn't come across so well in the governor's comments and the statements I've seen from the Department of Natural Resources, which pretty much sided with the business community and rejected the argument of the environmentalists, is the EPA rule, this was one announced on June 2nd of this year, provided enormous flexibility for the states. For one thing, the states have 3 years to submit a plan for how they will comply. They have 15 years to implement the plan. And EPA says you don't necessarily have to cut back on coal-fired power plants if that's too expensive. You could increase energy efficiency, promote energy conservation, increase reliance on renewable energy, which Wisconsin legs on compared to states such as Minnesota and Iowa. You could switch from coal to natural gas, which is a much cleaner fuel. So in other words, the state has many options. It isn't just closing down coal-fired power plants. And when you combine those options, then you begin to see the real benefits that the EPA is talking about, both for the state and for the nation.
Now, the governor has also said that electricity rates would increase by as much as 30% as a result of that proposal.
Yeah.
What is your take on that number? That's a significant hike to consumers,
if true. I think he's wrong. I'm looking at the EPA statement that goes with this proposal, and they anticipate, again, this is over time, because these rules wouldn't even take full effect until about 2030, that we would have a decrease of 8% on electricity bills nationally. Now, every state will be a little different depending on the path it chooses. That is, whether it chooses to switch to natural gas or renewables. And there was some information just in the last couple of weeks that solar and wind energy, for example, are becoming competitive with conventional fuels. And I would expect that as technology improves and research intensifies, that we could well see an energy saving because solar and wind and biofuels and natural gas will be cheaper than relying on coal. So that does not increase electricity prices. It will decrease them.
Wouldn't there be a ramping up period before maybe we saw the price decreases you're projecting could happen, time when prices could spike?
Yes. Well, again, I that would not surprise me because we're heavily dependent on coal. So what we could see is several years of price increases followed by declining prices. And, of course, the energy production segment of the economy has been going through a great deal of change lately. Everyone knows gasoline prices have been plummeting. So it's hard to predict, you know, what next year or the following year will bring. Natural gas fracking or fracturing has greatly reduced the cost of natural gas. I think many utilities would argue it's cheaper to build a natural gas plant than a coal plant or to switch from a coal plant to those that can be converted over to natural gas. Developing wind power, which Wisconsin is not doing nearly as much as Minnesota and Iowa, would also greatly reduce costs over time. Plus, let's remember that the purpose of this rule is to combat climate change, and there are enormous economic and environmental and public health costs that come with climate change. As you head off at least some of the impacts of climate change, society benefits economically, environmentally, and in terms of public health. So I understand people say, well, it's going to cost us too much to do this or to do that. But you have to look at the full equation. That is, over the long term, are the benefits going to exceed the cost? Will people be better off with this rule change? And obviously, I think so. And I'm somewhat saddened that the business community in the state and the DNR and the governor think otherwise. The EPA, of course, was soliciting comments. It's received many comments. We'll now see what the final rule proposes. And I hope the state chooses the wisest way to respond to this rule. Again, every state can respond differently. Every one of the 50 states will have a somewhat different plan. And I'd like to think in the next 3 years or so, we would develop a very sensible plan that benefits people within the state.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at the UW-Green Bay. There's an old saying in different versions, something along these lines. If you can remember the 60s, you weren't really there. But our next guest says it's important to remember the 60s as a vital turning point in American history and culture and to break through a lot of myths that can cloud our understanding about what really happened.
Craig Werner joins us in the studio now. He's a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tomorrow night he's giving a talk titled For What It's Worth, hence the song, Toward a New History of the 60s. That's 5:30 in Madison at the Elvium Building. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, before we get into the myths and realities, 50 years after the fact, why is it important for us to try to get the 60s right?
Well, the first response to that is sort of the Shakespeare and the Renaissance response, is that any time period that gave rise to the Beatles and Aretha Franklin and Motown and Bob Dylan is worth studying. But on a different level, I think it's because in many ways we're still fighting about the 60s. Bill Clinton once said that if you look back on the 60s and it's mostly positive, you're probably a Democrat. If you look back on the 60s and it's mostly negative, you're probably a Republican. And I think that that plays out in many ways in our contemporary life. It changed the world we're living in. We're still fighting about it.
We'll get into that a little more, but let's get into some of your guiding principles toward a new history of studying the 60s. How have the myths loomed larger than the actual reality? Have they loomed larger in some cases?
To a large extent, they have. I'm building the talk around five mantras, and the first of the mantras is that the myth of the 60s has replaced the memory of the 60s, even in the memory of those who lived it. There's a real tendency to either glorify or demonize the 60s, and particularly the part of the 60s you're in. And as I've been working on the book this is headed towards, what I've really found is that there is a lot of great work debunking the myths in about Vietnam or about the women's movement or about the civil rights movement. But what hasn't happened is those corrections haven't spread outside the subculture that focuses on it.
Hmm. Now, what are some of the other big overarching myths that we look back on, even starting early in the 60s?
Well, one of the myths I'm going to talk about tomorrow is the myth of Camelot, is the Kennedy administration is this wonderful time when poets and intellectuals crowded into the White House, and there was a real gleaming vision of what America could be. The reality of the Kennedy administration is that it was gritty. It was about real politics on every level. And that the myth of Camelot was consciously created by Jackie Kennedy within a couple of weeks after the president's death.
And did that assassination kind of create that myth in retrospect? It made it seem like it was some kind of different era of politics because of this big shock that happened?
I think it did. I think that without question, the Kennedy assassination was a rupture in the way that people were thinking and living their lives. But the particular way it was looked at was quite consciously created by Theodore White, one of the journalists and writers of the time, went about building it, went about constructing the way we think about it today.
And another big myth that that we look back at, I mean, I think when a lot of people think of the 60s, they think of the music and the drugs and counterculture. Is it fair to define that era just on those tropes in a way?
Absolutely not to define the era that way. Of course, they were a big part of it. Mm-hmm. You look at the Summer of Love, San Francisco, 1967. You're going to meet some gentle people there, as the song went. And very clearly, what you met was some gentle people and a whole lot of hustlers and a lot of hard-edged exploitation of kids. So the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, yeah, they were a piece of it, particularly as the decade went on. But they were all tied in with other stories.
Now, getting back to your mantras, speaking of JFK, the 60s are packed with larger-than-life figures, at least looking back from our perspective. Do we give them too much the limelight?
I think we do. My second mantra is the great man theory gets most of it wrong, including the great men. And as a scholar of African-American history, I love Martin Luther King, but the way that he's gone down into our cultural memory is in many ways just false. The notion that the civil rights movement was about Martin Luther King appealing to the American people and joining with his allies, the Kennedys, and we transformed American history and led the way to Barack Obama and post-racial America, simply not true. That violence was a part of the civil rights movement on all sides from the very beginning, and that focusing on Dr. King and leadership erases the reality that for many people, the civil rights movement was about the women who fought it out day by day in local communities and organized their people. If I have to choose one figure to represent the civil rights movement, it's going to be Ella Baker, who split from King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference and allied herself with the young students. And her mantra was, strong people don't need strong leaders. She knew they could kill the leaders. She knew that real change had to come from what happened within the community.
Well, how does that hurt us now to have this vision of this massive, amazing leader who single-handedly did everything?
I think we're always waiting for Moses in a real way. And they started calling King Moses early in the movement and kept calling him. And then some of the younger activists started calling him Delaud, which was their satirical take on that. But I think what it means today is that we tend to think that one person can transform reality, that if we elect Obama or whoever, that will change the world. And the real hard work takes place day by day, hour by hour in our communities. And I find my students are confused about that. And they also think that it's about protest, drawing attention to what's wrong with the world and expecting people in power to change it. That's the myth of King that we've gotten. It's not the way it happened.
And those women you mentioned, that's your third mantra, that we have to be careful not to overlook the role of women in the 60s.
Absolutely. That women were a part of every story. And even when they weren't famous and even when they weren't feminist, that you can look, if you're looking at any story in the 60s and the women are not a part of it, it's not the real story. The story of popular music, you know, which places the Beatles and Dylan at the center, overlooks the fact that the girl groups of the early 60s were some kind just blown off as music for nostalgic teen movies, that kind of thing. The reality is that they were sowing the seeds for feminism that would follow, and that they were talking about real issues amongst themselves and placing women's voices at the center, not to mention the fact that they were crucial in transforming consumer culture, creating the national culture, which is another big piece of the 60s.
Another huge piece of the 60s was the Cold War, and it was U.S. against the Soviet Union, and you say that can lead us down some blind alleys, just looking at a bipartisan or bipolar, I should say, world.
Yeah, that we look at the Cold War as if it was the East versus the West, and there's some good reasons for doing that, the biggest of which is the threat of nuclear annihilation, which, living in a military town in the early 60s, I grew up with that. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis and just the threat that we might blow it all up. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that once you move beyond that and start dealing with Vietnam or Indonesia or Africa or, as far as that goes, Czechoslovakia or Mexico, there are factors in play that are not about the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It's not as simple as communism and capitalism. A group of French intellectuals really pushed and introduced the notion of the Third World, as we think about it. But Mao Zedong in China talked about Third Worldism as yet a different way of looking at the world, with the superpowers on one level. Soviet Union and U.S. are part of the same thing from that perspective. The industrialized nations on another, and then the developing nations as a third. And that's the lens that China was looking through when it made its decisions about how to deal with, say, Vietnam.
And a lot of foreign policy since the Cold War, I think, maybe surprised us because we weren't looking at it through those lenses.
Absolutely. And we seem very resistant to it. I mean, we're in a political culture, and I think this comes out of the 60s in many ways, which is it's either or. It's red state, blue state. We want a simple, binary, bipolar, us versus them construction. Ronald Reagan played on that brilliantly, and he established himself doing that in the 60s. He ran for governor of California against the University of California at Berkeley and won overwhelmingly. And the simplifications are comforting in some ways, except that they don't work.
And another myth that you want to bust, I know, is that 60s politics were all about the left.
Yeah, and they weren't. They just weren't. That both in the United States and internationally, the right was as important and as complex as the left. One of the case studies of that for me is the way that race played out in American politics. We think of African Americans as being a Democratic constituency today, but the fact is at the beginning of the 1960s, with the Democratic Party firmly entrenched in the South, the smart money would have said that every reason to think that African Americans could become a Republican constituency. There are complications with that economically. But Nelson Rockefeller, who looked like he was going to be the Republican nominee for president in 1964 until a very ill-considered divorce, was actively cultivating the African American vote. Martin Luther King voted Republican in 1956. And that changed. The Barry Goldwater candidacy changed that. George Wallace changed that. But there were real tensions within the right that could conceivably have created a very different world.
How did the 1960s, as we wrap up, set up the political world of today with spin and political theater?
Theater was a big part of the 1960s, and that began as early as the Camelot myth. Theodore White, who wrote The Making of the President in 1960, very important book, created myths that the Kennedy people knew what they were doing at every step. They clearly didn't. But it was putting the spin on it that the New Left was absolutely aware that they were performing street theater in Chicago. Martin Luther King knew that he was presenting an image for consumption on middle-class white televisions in the North. And very famous moment when Joan Baez gets mad at demonstrators and starts to respond to him. And Dr. King says, no, the cameras, she got it.
And having lived through it, it wasn't a guarantee that we remember it right.
No, it really wasn't. I have to fight that all the time myself. As you get sucked into your own story, the music can make me nostalgic. It can, if I don't watch it, it can make me stupid. And I think as a culture, we've let ourselves become stupid about the 60s.
We'll leave it there. Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you much.
That was Craig Werner, professor of Afro-American Studies at the UW-Madison. He's speaking in Madison tomorrow at 5:30 at the Elvium Building. More info at the UW-Madison Center for the Humanities website. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We've gotten through Black Friday and Cyber Monday, the kickoff to the holiday retail shopping season. Today, nonprofits around the world are trying to send a different holiday message.
Today is Giving Tuesday, an effort to capture the holiday spirit and turn it towards philanthropy and encourage people to give their time and money to causes they support. And we want to hear from you. Where do you volunteer? What causes do you like to support? Or is there a local effort that could use a boost? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lisa Dietlin joins us now. She's a philanthropy expert and president and CEO of Lisa M. Dietlin & Associates. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, Veronica and Rob. Good, happy Tuesday, I should say.
Well, happy Tuesday to you, too, and happy Giving Tuesday.
Giving Tuesday.
Tell us a little bit about this idea. What's the thinking behind Giving Tuesday?
Well, the thinking behind Giving Tuesday was, you know, most of us have become pretty tired of the commercialization of the holiday season and the idea of if 80% of charities receive 50% of their budgets during these last 2 months of the year, why don't we have a dedicated day? So 2 years ago, this is the third year, some folks came up with the idea of Giving Tuesday, the idea of setting aside the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving, you know, after Black Friday and Small Business Saturday and whatever we do on Cyber Monday now that the pundits say we don't do as much as we used to with the cyber shopping, to actually dedicate a day for charities to say, why don't we raise some money on this day and think about giving back to others?
So what kind of things do charities and other nonprofit groups do on Giving Tuesday to try to kickstart that?
Well, most of them have been planning for quite a while. We recommend they start planning in August, September. So they start planting seeds. And this year, the big trend is the unselfie. You know, the hashtag, you know how we all take selfies and we post them on our social media. And this year's the hashtag of the unselfie, actually showing people doing something for someone else, for an organization, for a nonprofit, giving back and making a difference in their community. So that's trending. That's something that they can do. Definitely, they're asking for money. You know, if they rely on this time of year, November and December, to raise a majority of their budget, they're asking people to contribute, and a lot of them have matching gifts. I just saw that Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is matching donations for, you know, donations to eliminating polio, and that's, of course, through the Rotary, and so a lot of nonprofit organizations have matching gifts. So you can be smart and double your donation by finding a nonprofit that actually has a matching gift.
Well, we saw huge successes earlier this year with the Ice Bucket Challenge as a fundraising social media effort. Short of that, that seems to be sort of the pinnacle lately. But what can listeners do to spread the message of giving and to help their efforts go viral, even on maybe if it's not quite on that big scale?
Right. Well, you know, hats off to ALS and what they were able to do, because they were the first nonprofit that was able to break through social media and monetize it in the charitable sector. And they did it because they made it something that everybody could do and that it was accessible. You know, it had originally started off as something that you had to be near cold water. It was Cold Water Challenge. And, you know, if you live in Nebraska, perhaps there's not water there for you to jump into, and perhaps it's not cold if you're in Texas. And so the idea is to, whatever you're going to do on social media, use that model of ALS and make it accessible to all. So some of the suggestions are, you know, to, as I said, take a photo of yourself as the unselfie. Set up a live giving station. You know, go to your favorite coffee shop. Go to your favorite, you know, neighborhood place where you gather with the moms, the dads, the nannies, what have you, the kids that are playing, and sit around and say, here's my laptop. Let's all pick a nonprofit that we want to contribute our dollars to, and let's donate the money. Collect money. Another thing is this layaway angel trend that's going through the country is the idea of my family, instead of exchanging gifts, we collect money that we would spend on gifts and then go in and pay off someone's layaway so that they have a happy holiday season. You know, the layaway model came back through the department stores when the economy became really tough, and it still exists at department stores, and people are pleasantly surprised when they get the call from the layaway clerk that an angel has anonymously paid off their layaway so that their gifts can be out of layaway in time for the holiday season. You can give blood. You can shovel someone's sidewalk. You could pay for a cup of coffee. You could, in Illinois, we have toll roads. You can pay for, you know, the toll behind you. There are so many things you could do today that would make a difference and help on Giving Tuesday.
Well, that reminds me, I think when people hear words like philanthropy and charitable giving, they may think of the Bill and Melinda the Gateses of the world, the big donors. Do those kind of smaller donations and those little acts of kindness really make a difference?
They absolutely do, Rob. You know, philanthropy is just a grown-up word for sharing. I love that definition of it. You know, everybody's a philanthropist. You know, when you hold the door open for somebody, when you smile at somebody, when you, you know, sweep somebody's walk or shovel their steps off with a snowstorm as we get in Wisconsin and here in Illinois, that is actually being a philanthropist. You know, my first book I wrote, it was called Transformational Philanthropy, and the women I interviewed, the women entrepreneurs, said to me, philanthropy is more than just money. It's a hug. It's a smile. It's carrying in someone's groceries. It's babysitting someone's kids. It's doing something unexpected and kind for somebody. The women got that message. No offense to your male listeners, but they actually articulated the word. So anybody can be a philanthropist. You know, I was kayaking on the Chicago River last summer, and the coach or the guide, you know, down the river, you know, was keeping up with me. I was in the last of the pack, and he said, you know, what do you do when you're exchanging information, young kid? He goes, you know, my friend doesn't have any money to give away. He said, but he smiles and acknowledges everybody all day long because he read somewhere that the number one reason people who are contemplating suicide don't do it is that somebody acknowledged them or smiled at them. And he said, my friend is pretty sure when he puts his head on the pillow at night, he saved a life. And that, to me, is philanthropy. Whether you have money, a little bit, no money, a lot of it, you can make a difference in other people's lives. And that's what Giving Tuesday is all about, changing the world, dedicating some resources and time on a specific day that we can all gather around.
Well, we're heading into, you know, the thick of the holiday season. Are there suggestions you have with not just yourself, but getting family and friends on board with maybe funneling more of what you might give to each other outward?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think it's absolutely wonderful to gather family members around, especially those who might say, you know, if you have those aunts and uncles who say, oh, I have everything, I don't need anything, or those hard-to-buy poor people. There's a couple of suggestions. One is many nonprofit organizations, Veronica, have giving catalogs. You think of Heifer International. You know, you can buy a cow, you can buy a flock of geese. From $20 to $500 you could spend, and that actually, that animal would be given to a family in a third world or developing country. And here's what they're finding out, Veronica and Rob, that those families that are receiving those animals, they are becoming donors because they're giving their eggs to the neighbors or the milk to the person down the road that might not have the resources that they were given. So Heifer International is a great catalog to go through and to start purchasing things that, you know, in the name of someone else for a gift to be given to a third world, a family in a third world or developing country. UNICEF has two catalogs. They have a catalog similar to Heifer with mosquito netting or, you know, water salination tablets you can buy. And again, they have baskets, gardening baskets, first aid baskets, education baskets. The money can be from as little as $20, $30 to, you know, several hundred dollars. But this year they have a catalog called the Marketplace, which actually has items made by people in third world and developing countries. So you think about jewelry or bracelets made by the women of the Maasai or clothing made from, you know, people that live in the Himalayas or in Ecuador or what have you. And you can actually buy a nice gift for somebody while giving back to charity. So there's a way to shop charitably if you actually want to shop, but also you could do things like, we're going to gather our resources together and we're going to, you know, decorate the neighbor's house, the elderly woman who, you know, doesn't have anybody in her family around her, and we're going to make sure that she has a nice holiday season. So it's about having the conversation and figuring out where you want to enter as a family and making it a tradition. One other thing I'd share is I see grandparents often giving their grandchildren the lesson of philanthropy by giving them each $10 or $15, maybe $20, depending on their age, and saying to them, as their eyes get really big because grandma and grandpa actually gave them money, saying, but you have to do something with this that helps somebody else. And those grandparents actually tell me that year after year, the grandchildren come back and say, I want to do that again next year. So teaching the lesson of philanthropy, too. So whether it's $5 or $500, you can really make a difference in utilizing the charitable aspect of the holiday season.
Yeah, how important is it to get kids involved at an early age, again, on a small scale, in philanthropy?
I think it's really important, Rob. I think it's the key to our society that, you know, our when I interviewed entrepreneurs about their earliest memories of philanthropy, they all said they remembered usually their mom, but sometimes they said their family doing something around the holidays and around food. You know, their mom making a food basket or the family inviting another family over for a meal that might not have a meal available at their home. And they all had that very vivid memory. So even though it wasn't formalized, we're taught that at our home, you know, in a way that is just second nature to our families to take in those who perhaps are less needy. In this society where perhaps we don't know our neighbors, we might be a little further removed from it. So I think it's really critical to explain to people, especially young children, you know, what is happening in this world, that perhaps there's people who don't have the items that they have, and there's a way to give back and to feel good about that. I actually have friends whose young children, when they have birthday parties, and it's usually around the age of 8, 9, or 10, say, I don't want anything. I don't want any presents. When people come to my birthday, I'd like them to bring an item that we could donate to the animal shelter. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's just beautiful. You know, that, you know, these kids love cats and dogs and understand that their family can only adopt one or two, but there's so many more cats or dogs at the shelter. And so they ask all the little kids coming to bring an item that could be donated then to the animal shelter. I think, you know, sitting down with kids and saying, okay, you have all these toys and all these books and the majority of them that you've never read or looked at in the last year, 18 months, why don't we pick some out and give them to other children who might not have as many books or as many toys as you have this holiday season?
It's Giving Tuesday. We're talking to philanthropy expert Lisa Dietland, and you can join the conversation.
We continue our conversation with philanthropy expert Lisa Dietland. She's talking about Giving Tuesday and sharing some advice and inspiration for our donations and our volunteer efforts.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where do you volunteer? Where do you donate? Do you know of Wisconsin, a local group that needs a boost, needs some help in this holiday season? And Wisconsin's ranked 44th in the country for giving, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy. They looked at IRS data. The average Wisconsin household claimed contributions totaling 3.4% of discretionary income. Well, are you trying to change that trend and encourage other people to give? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our first caller now. Andrew joins us in Madison. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you all?
Good, thank you. What would you like to choose to donate to, or what are you thinking about this season?
Sure. I'm thinking a lot, actually, about, luckily I've had the opportunity lately to give a lot of my time to different organizations around Madison. One that comes to mind specifically, I've been working really closely with the Resilience Neighborhood Center and the Badger Rock Neighborhood Center on the south side of Madison that's doing some amazing work in the city. And then also on top of that, Citizens Climate Lobby Group is a great organization that I've had the chance to work with, and it's just really accessible for anyone who wants to volunteer just a little bit of their time, writing letters to the editor, writing letters to their representatives about issues that are important to them, like climate change.
Great. Well, thank you so much for telling about it. So working time in as a volunteer effort is a way to give. That's something that's especially in need over the holiday season, right, Lisa?
Absolutely it is, Veronica. And also I would say there are a lot of movements now where you can give online. You can virtually be a virtual volunteer. I sit on the advisory board of a national group called Women on Call. There's, you know, Volunteer Match. And a lot of nonprofit organizations are offering opportunities where you can volunteer from your home and add your skills. So, for instance, we worked with a nonprofit organization that didn't have a budget for graphic artists to design their invitations. And so a woman from Georgia helped a nonprofit in Illinois through an organization started in Chicago, and she created all the graphic arts for the response card and the save the date and the invitation and the posters. And, you know, she did it from her home. She was a virtual volunteer. So, you know, don't think that you have to go out in the cold and, you know, deal with the elements of the weather. There's also a way that we make it easy for you to volunteer.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to John with us in Windsor. Hi, John.
Hi. You know, about 30 years ago, my grandmother passed away, and she had not a lot of money. And my parents inherited a small amount. They gave each one of us kids $1,000. And they said, okay, here's $1,000, but this is the deal. You need to use at least half of that money to donate to some worthy organization. And so what I did is I worked with the individuals with disabilities, and there's a conference. So I donated money to help some parents attend the conference. And from that, somebody said, well, why don't you start a nonprofit foundation? So in the last 25 years, we have given out over $250,000 in scholarships.
Wow.
And it's, you know, it's not like it's a lot of stuff. It's a bunch of people working together. And, you know, the amazing thing is that the people that that we give money to, they come back and they volunteer because they understand that they got something and they want to give back as well. So it grows itself.
John.
Yeah, so small money can do a lot of good.
That's amazing. John, thank you. Congratulations on that effort, and thanks so much for sharing it with us. Lisa, these things can really snowball, it sounds like.
It does snowball, and I'm smiling from ear to ear, and I want to jump up and high-five the caller, and that is just a beautiful story. And, you know, friends coming together, you know, when you can even turn Black Friday into a charitable day. You know, use those coupons, I tell people when that was coming up, and use your resources with friends and go out and shop for a nonprofit organization and the needs that they have. So, you know, a small group of people, you know, you think 20 people each with $100 and you have coupons, you might be able to buy $5,000 or $10,000 worth of stuff to donate to charity with the deals. And there's just so many ways coming together, as the caller explained, that you can really make a difference with not a lot of money. And everybody is a philanthropist, no matter the size, the time, whatever they do to give back to help another human being.
Well, thank you for that call. And let's go next to Stephanie in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
Hi, what is your story?
At the church we go to, they always have an angel tree every year, and we've always donated to it. Sometimes my son's helped pick things out, sometimes he hasn't. And he knew it was going to, you know, be again this year, and he's in college, freshman, and decided that he was going to do the angel tree there without my even bringing it up or anything. And so, you know, it's obvious that it does just that little bit of it, you know, doing it through the whatever. The kids do catch on to that and know the importance of it. I think maybe part of his knowing the importance of it is 1 year, actually it was 2 years, but 1 year that we took advantage of the angel tree, we had to take care advantage of it because my husband was unemployed and we were not going to have a Christmas if we hadn't gotten something from that. So, you know, it shows in both ends of it, the giving and the receiving, which I think is helpful.
Well,
I mean, not that you
so want
to lose your job just to, you know, learn the getting, but, you know, It's just nice that the kids do pay it forward and they do learn from parents' examples.
Great. Thank you so much, Stephanie. That's a great story. And Lisa, is that something that, you know, parents should really be aware of, that it's not a one-off thing giving? You're really sort of instilling lessons that can carry forward through the next generations.
It absolutely is, Veronica. The kids are always watching. They're always paying attention, you know. And research has been done, studies have been done, that the habits that parents have, the children will emulate. So if you're a giver, if you're a kind person, we're going to raise a generation. The next generation are going to be philanthropists. They're going to be givers, and they're going to be kind people. And they're going to make sure that the person who doesn't have the resources they have is taken care of. You know, that's how this country was founded. We just celebrated Thanksgiving, and you think about, you know, the Pilgrims and the Indians coming together and celebrating a feast of the harvest they had together and sharing what they had. And we were founded on that principle, and I think this next generation is just going to amaze us with the use of technology and the exchange of information and their parents leading the way.
Stephanie, thanks for that story. We've got Richard on the line now in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. And I think this Giving Day is a wonderful thing, and to publicize giving is something. And I think it really has to come, you know, from the heart. And you're doing something for somebody because they need something. And I think so many people today do not realize how much they really have. I've been working with prisoners for Good News Jail and Prison Ministry, and it's a wonderful organization. And it's always so rewarding to get done with a session, and people are thanking you for being there.
All right, Richard, I've got to jump in. That's a great place to leave it. The benefits to ourselves for helping too. Lisa Dietlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, happy Giving Tuesday, and thank you for having me. And thank you to everyone who's listening for all they do to give back and make a difference.
And thanks to everyone who shared their story. You can keep sharing at the Central Time Facebook page. We've been talking to Lisa Dietlin about Giving Tuesday. She's a philanthropy expert and president and CEO of Lisa M. Dietlin & Associates.